7944.
I'm talking to John Cage in New York. John, you composed a piece that was performed the other evening as part of the Ear Benefit concert at St. Bartholomew's Church.
I called it Ear for Ear, thinking of the omission in the Bible of ear for ear. They say tooth for a tooth and an eye for an eye, but they didn't say anything about the ear.
Well, it's been said now.
Yes. I didn't really mean to cut off an ear. If someone cut off an ear, I meant rather that this piece was based on the letters E-A-R, and that it was composed and intended to be performed so that it could be heard rather than seen, except the what would you call it, the announcer or the instigator would say ear.
Yes.
And then those responding would be invisible. I love that. There's an instrument that is mysterious in the same way that it gives you illusions about space. It's the Japanese temple gong. Do you know that? And it's when it's played as one plays a glass in a cafe, you know, by dampening your finger and then going around the edge. In the temple gong, if you take a heavy leather-covered wooden beater and rub around very slowly around the edge of the gong, even very large ones, the sound that's generated comes from one doesn't know exactly where.
Just carrying on talking a little bit about sound. You've explored sound really in a very broad sense, and in many senses, in a total sense, from sound produced by man-made instruments. To sound that naturally occurs in the environment. As with the Russian futurists who used the sounds of industrial equipment and factory whistles and sirens and so on, do you believe that an interest in using natural sounds stems from the fact of the idea that perhaps Western musical conventions in themselves can't adequately express and reflect ideas about the moment we live, the contemporary world?
Well, one could have those ideas, but what I was doing primarily was ignoring the difference between noises and musical tones, and trying to make a larger group which could be called sounds, and that would include both of those. Just as the word humanity includes the rich and the poor. So my notion of sounds is all of them. Not just noises and not just musical tones, but all of them. We often say, after hearing a group of sounds, we say the name of the composer, like Beethoven. I would rather remember the sounds. This stems from a Buddhist idea that all beings, whether sentient like human beings or non-sentient like sounds or stones, all beings are the Buddha. So that we're living in an interpenetration of centers rather than moving toward one center. Mm. Sometimes people get the idea or get the experience, and it changes their way of living, and sometimes they don't. I remember a lady who years and years ago, it was in the 30s when I was just beginning in Seattle, and I had a percussion orchestra and I was working just with noises, and she had been in the hospital, and she came. She's a fairly well-known person, Nancy Wilson Ross. Do you know her name? she's an authority on Oriental Buddhist thoughts and so forth. Anyway, she came to the concert of percussion music, and she was supposed to go back to the hospital, but she decided not to. She simply went home. And other people have told me that after hearing a concert in which noises are honored as well as musical sounds, that they listen to the sounds around them with more attention than they had previously. This is also for me the effect of modern painting on my eyes, so that when I go around the city, I look at the walls, and don't you do that? And I look at the pavement and so forth, as though I'm in a museum or in a gallery. In other words, I don't turn my aesthetic faculties off when I'm outside a museum.
Hmm? Right. That's a nice idea. In fact, you've mentioned...
Or gallery.
You've mentioned visual arts, and of course you're very well known in a visual arts context. Mm-hmm. And you've functioned with, worked with a lot of artists like Rauschenberg, Jobs, mm-hmm. and so on. Is this something, do you think, that is specifically to do with being a composer, an avant-garde composer in America? During the period you've worked.
That it has to do also with the visual arts?
Well, yes, and that you've worked very much in conjunction with artists, perhaps rather than...
Don't you?
I
think it must be because, you see, musicians at the beginning would not accept my work as music. They told me quite frankly in the 30s that what I was doing was wrong, whereas dancers accepted what I was doing. So I was accepted almost immediately into the world of theater. And the world of theater includes the visual arts, includes poetry, includes singing, you know. I mean, theater is what we're really living in. So that later, when we had that group of David Tudor, Christian Wolff, Martin Feldman, and Earl Brown, and myself, I think the thing that distinguished my work from the others, if I may say so, I don't know whether they'd agree or not, but I think that what distinguished it was that it was more theatrical. Hmm? My experience is theatrical. Hmm? I like the other arts. I don't like to close my eyes when I'm listening to music. And the little bit of that is what's implied in that ear for ear. I mean, you really have to, I mean, as you keep your ears open, you also want to look, don't you? And see if you can see what is unseen.
I was wondering if you felt there was an intrinsic difference between working as an independent individual composer or working in collaboration with others, because you collaborate.
Well, you
with
see,
I've
found a way
Cunningham.
To collaborate with Merce Cunningham, so that we really don't have to collaborate. We simply do our work separately after the most common sense agreement, say 25 minutes, and whether or not it's what you might call a humorous piece, or whether it's going to be a serious piece, and then we simply work separately, and we put it together in the theater.
Do you work with any visual artists at the moment? Visual
I have a very good and close friend, William Anastasi, whose work I enjoy, and we play chess a great deal together. But we haven't collaborated on any actual work, though we might. and his friend, Dove Bradshaw, I like her work. I remain devoted to Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg. And I loved the work of Mark Tobey and Morris Graves, though I rarely see Morris. Did you know there's going to be a large retrospective of his work? I think it opens, in fact, tonight in Washington, D.C. at the Phillips Gallery. And it'll come to the Whitney Museum here. I think it will be a blessing to see his work at the present time in the century. I mean a blessing in relation to, say, the exhibitions of Schnabel and other such things, which suggest the negation of art. Hmm? I don't like it. I don't accept it. I suppose Wittgenstein would say that I should take a clicker out of my pocket and click it, in order to transform it into the beautiful. But I think that it's full of intention on the part of Schnabel, and I think the intentions are wrong intentions. I think it's intentional work, and I do not like it. And I don't even think the intentions are good. And I don't think the promotion of his work by the galleries is good either. I have no further confidence in Leo Castelli or Mary Boone. I work, as you know, using chance operations, and all of my work since the 50s can be said to be non-intentional. I have tried to get, as Thoreau tried 100 years ago, to get myself out of the way of the sounds. And that's exactly what Tobey did with his white writing. And that is not apolitical. It's anarchic. And it turns out, politically speaking, to be stronger than any statement such as Schnabel's. I would say, for instance, that the work of Thoreau, which is anarchic, and which changed India, which changed Martin Luther King, which helped the Danes in their resistance to Hitler, I would say that these ideas are very strong socially, even though they are non-intentional. Each morning that Thoreau got up, his head was absolutely empty. He became an observer of the world around him rather than a person who went like Schnabel, full of intention, into it each day. That was why he was so disliked in Concord. He even would go out without a stitch on. Did you know that? He would walk in winter, stark naked, through the main streets of Concord, simply because he felt an identification with wherever he was. I don't think that art has to do with understanding what's happening, which is what many people think now. I think art has to do with, I believe, Joyce, your compatriot, felt. It has to do with mystery, keeping things mysterious. And that mystery leads to experience, but not to understanding. I would rather be baffled than to be clear, than to know what's going on. If I know what's going on, I no longer have to go on.
You mentioned Joyce.
I'm really astonished. Yes, I'm really astonished that people think that Finnegan's Wake is, for instance, elitist, and that it's not for the man in the street. Whereas Joyce himself said it was written by the man in the street, didn't he? No, I love Joyce and intend to go on loving Joyce. And precisely because I don't understand it. I'm not a Joyce scholar. I'm a Joyce enjoyer.
Yeah. this.
I'm an angicer.
Following on from that idea, you've said also that, quoting you, I'm losing my ability to make connections because the ones I do make so belittle the natural complexity.
Right,
which
right.
is really reiterating right. what you've just said.
Exactly, yes. I know that many people think that I'm going in the wrong direction, but I don't see that it does any harm for all of us to have me do this.
You can
then tell what happens when those views are held.
But this anarchic kind of idea. I mean, do you still see yourself? I mean, clearly you have been, but do you still see yourself as still a kind of counter thrust within American culture and ideas?
I'm not sure that I know all of the things that are going on. I know some of them. And you catch me now between trips. I was just in Boston and Buffalo, and before that I was in Vancouver, British Columbia, and Miami. And I have the feeling that in some very real sense I'm out of step with the younger people.
Is your very strong interest in fungi still taking place?
Yes, and my botanical interests are extended now to include the equisita. It's the horsetails. They're one of the most ancient plants. In the time of the dinosaurs, they were 100 feet high, and now they're merely lowly weeds. They're allies of the ferns. And I'm attempting now in this indoor situation to gather as many species as I can. They're not edible. Well, I guess all the plants I have would fall under the heading ornamental plants. Actually, I think they may be satisfying a deep need in me for sculpture. I never really liked sculpture, including good sculpture. I never really could put up with it. But I love plants, and they are, of course, like sculpture. They sit in space. But I love it that they change. And I love that aspect of Bob Rauschenberg's sculpture. That when you look at it and it's just sitting there still, it generally has parts, and you can see immediately that they could move in relation to one another. Thank you.
Thank you. per una fetta di tappone.
That was Erin by Joan LaBarbera, and the next item on this tape is a commentary by Rosalie Goldberg. The piece Hudson River Sound Map by Ania Lockwood now appears on side one of this cassette toward the end after the Christopher Price interview. But now back to Rosalie Goldberg and a commentary from a rather noisy bar off West Broadway in Manhattan.
Rosalie, you've been here in New York since 1976 and been coming into New York, such as I've done, for a short period of time. It's very difficult to actually become very focused about what is taking place here, what are the particular interests and intensities that can be seen. Where would you say the kind of key areas are? I mean, who are the kind of interesting artists that are working here at the moment? Because there's an awful lot of work, there's no question about that, but seeing through the sort of the mass of it, you know, where are the particular focuses of attention for you?
I'm going to sidetrack a little in answer to your question, because I think you've actually come to New York in a very, very interesting year. In fact, I would say the last 3 years have been explosive and very difficult for anybody who's just briefly coming in, and yet also very exciting to do that, because you can suddenly, in a nutshell, see how the city works. Last year was actually even more unnerving, because I think a lot of the Europeans were suddenly being shown in the city, and the younger artists, the painters that people are talking about right now, have had a year to settle and are actually being forced into producing work that measures on a different scale to the one that's about being new and being very much hyped about, which was last year. I'm avoiding names right now for a very specific reason, because I think that the city has seen a very interesting transformation from a period, let's say, when I was at the Kitchen from 78 to 80, when performance was really at its peak. In fact, I almost look on the 70s as the golden years of performance, and seeing how by the end of 78 and beginning of 79, 80, at a time when, for instance, in the Kitchen at the gallery, I was showing people like Robert Longo, Matt Mullican, Troy Bruntak, Cindy Sherman, Jack Goldstein. These are all names that right now are very, very high-powered names in the young emerging artists. What this leads to, in a sense, is I think two of the main poles right now, of which comes back to your first question. I think there's work that's very much coming out of American media and very much coming out of the children of the 70s, and by that I mean extremely sophisticated artists, the students of the conceptual art, of conceptual artists. If you think of Dennis Oppenheim, Vito Conti, John Baldessari, Keith Sonnier, name all that generation that was so important educationally for these younger artists. These people were very key in informing the questions that I think we're actually now seeing the flourishing. That's almost, I would look at as one component of the scene right now. It's a the other side is the move towards painting, which obviously you're experiencing enormously in Europe, and the renaissance of European painting, and which everybody is obviously feeling very, very strongly. And I think the young American artists that I'm mentioning are, if you want, the children of what was so important in the 70s and 60s in American art. And you're seeing the European response to this and the reply. And it's very much a tennis match going on. I think the two are hand in hand. I don't think it's a separation. What I'm trying to lead to, and it's a very complicated and very fascinating story, because I've been so very close to it through the Kitchen, was literally seeing this move towards making objects again and seeing how that was a reflection, a response to a lot of performance. It's no coincidence that Laurie Anderson was also emerging at the same time as these people. It's no coincidence that 78 was really the high moment for the clubs, the Mud Club, CBGBs in New York. There was an enormous club scene. If I think of Bruce McLean being here about that time, he can tell you all about the time we had in New York. It was very much about this extraordinary excitement, the interaction of popular culture with the art world, which hasn't ever existed anywhere else. I don't think there's been that. And really, 78, 79 was this really very, very exciting moment. I mean, we were all hanging out all the time. And in an intelligent way, if there's such a thing to do. It was about really looking for work, looking for ways in which you could do a performance at the kitchen and do it at the Mud Club, have your art audience at the kitchen and yet have your kids from wherever, although, of course, the Mud was very much starting out as an artist's bar. There was a very serious sense that you were trying out your work in both areas. Somebody like Rhys Chatham could talk very articulately about how, to him, the art world was a kind of this comforting experimental area for him, and yet he had to keep crossing back and forth and go into the Mud to try and see what happens to that same work in a different context. Brian Eno, I think, was very important in those early stages for a lot of these artists. And I think the music scene, being as strong as it was in the late 70s, was very important to that crossover, because that music allowed a popular audience, or it had the potential. I think punk music, both in the English form and the American form, all this was very much very important for a lot of these artists who had very purist leanings in terms of what their mentors like Vito or John Baldessari, depending whether they're East Coast or West Coast, were proposing. And they were also very much analyzing a popular culture, if you want. I mean, somebody like John Baldessari was very much about image, was very much about pictures. It was very much the focus that we're seeing now, but almost restructured in a more conservative, not even conservative, I don't know if that matters, but certainly like how to reintegrate it and what is, like going back to a more traditional view of what the art world is, or what the art world, of what art is, i.e. painting. So that's the I would describe, and there are a lot of nuances here, and I can go on and on in a lot of detail about the history and how I see each person coming out of a different framework. And how you see the influence of film for one. One kind of film for David Sally, for instance, like Cirque, is a filmmaker who he's fascinated by, and his notion of melodrama that's very important that comes out in David Sally's paintings. Robert Longo's visions of the producer, of the filmmaker, of the director, of the image, and how he used that. Jack Goldstein, how he used, you know, extracted image. Cindy Sherman with her starting point of kind of black and white movies from the 60s, almost looking to European movies. There's a lot of different... Now, this, coming from my own perspective in the performance world, was very interesting, because I could literally see this move towards making more traditional work. And again, from a historical perspective, I was fascinated by those crossovers by someone like, say, Oscar Schlemmer, who was literally also trying to balance being both performer and painter. Okay, so that's almost like one aspect. The other side then is, as I say, the European strength in painting. And I think we all saw that in 1972 at the Biennale with people like Gerald Richter, that remained with me for a long, long time, that magnificent show that he had there. I don't know if you saw that, but, you know, the big black and white portraits, and then the paintings in the other room. So there was this ongoing interest in painting that was so much a strength on the European side, and yet they were looking at this media-oriented notion that was so strong in an American context, and yet which they could never equate, because... I mean, that's, for me, is still the shock about living in the States. The media is so rampant. It really is a media landscape that you're dealing with. It's not about going out and looking at the fields and remembering a kind of Italian peasantry or an Italian spatial sense. It really is a media landscape that these people were dealing with in terms of their background, their thinking, their brains. I mean, it's not a reading culture. It's a culture that looks. It's a culture that listens. You know, to television. So these are the two poles that I think really come to incredible fruition in New York. When you go down the street, on one side of the street, you're seeing a Clemente, and seeing even him being understood very well, I think, in an American context, because of a showmanship and because of an understanding of a sort of glamorousness that I think is coming back into work. And then you see Schnabel very consciously picking up a sort of European position in relation to painting, but with a very extremely American point of view in terms of brashness and in terms of lack of history in a way, and not inhibited at all by history. I mean, he couldn't care less if one piece is a, you know, is a John's or this and that all combined together. I mean, again, I think that kind of audacity was also something picked up in a European context with the Italians, who are kind of lifting in this very historical way and very blatantly. Then, of course, if you wanted to get down to details, we could talk about postmodernism, both in terms, which I loathe the word, but nevertheless, in its most general term, just I'll use it in its most undiluted and untheoretical terms, meaning for me representing a notion of lifting kind of from the 20s, which is, you know, people, everyone will put their arms up and say there's more to it. Yes, there is, but somehow it represents that looking back and kind of being able to restore memory and just do it blatantly and use it as a kind of whole cross-referencing language. Stop me, anyway. So, I mean, I do think there are these two very, very interesting poles, and I think that each one of the artists represents a very different approach, whether it is to media or in the European context to a history of painting. And I think that there's a fabulous clashing of these two sensibilities. Now, whether Americans from the inside see it that way or Europeans on the outside, I guess I straddle both sides, and I tend to be very, very aware of those two things coming together here.
You're hearing Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
So, this is it.
It's the 7-inch stretch. Everybody stands up. Okay, now look at you've got the whole stadium, and this is again something fairly common in America. This is the proverbial 7th inning stretch.
Right.
They're playing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, and everybody gets up and has a good stretch.
Right. Well, I should just say that we're in Yankee Stadium, New York, and this is Bob George explaining what's going on.
We were going to explain art, but we decided that it was much more relevant to today's young Englishman to learn about baseball and money than about and New York than about art, so, because they're synonymous, right?
Right.
And so, we're having fun.
So baseball is about a lot of money too.
Absolutely. Basically, you try to pay. This is team as a team that. The Yankees are a team that buys players rather than trains them. There you are. Now everybody's being shown, scanned on this 85-foot color monitor that shows you close-ups of the game and close-ups of the crowd.
Yeah.
So what should we do? Explain the game.
Yeah.
It's pretty impossible. Basically, the idea is for somebody called the pitcher to throw a ball so hard and so fast that the guy who's called the batter can't hit it. And you get three strikes, okay? And a strike means it's a chance at hitting the ball. And if he misses it all three times, then he's three strikes and you're out. I mean, a lot of baseball always ends up as American sort of common parlance, like three strikes and you're out, a foul ball, or...
Yeah.
A foul just basically means that it's outside of... it doesn't count at all. It's outside of the lines, outside of the foul lines.
Right.
And basically... somebody who's committed a foul, I'm sure that happens in soccer too, right?
Yeah, it's like being beyond the pale.
Yeah.
Euphemism.
Okay, and basically...
there's so much noise here, I hope we can be heard. I think we can.
Well, it holds about, 66,000 people?
Well, I was going to say, how many people here? It's absolutely amazing. I mean,
and this is opening day, so it's the first day of the year. Basically, the Yankees are... they paid a lot of money to get the best players from a lot of other teams. And they hope that they're paying all this money. Like Dave Winfield is a player that gets $3 million a year.
$3 million a year.
Right, that's about 1,500, I mean, what? 1,500,000 pounds or 200 million, or 2 million pounds.
Per year.
Right,
that's
per year.
That's absolutely amazing.
But you see that there's only 9 players, so it's not so bad. And it also, you figure that, what, there's there's 60,000 people come in, they each paying $8, they're each, if they can buy a beer, which is very hard. That's something that's different in England too, isn't it? Here, openly, wine and beer can be bought at the stadium.
So what?
Now, we've just had a hit. The pitcher from the other team, which is Detroit today, has thrown the ball as best he can to the batter, and he's hit it. Now we don't have the ball bounce like in cricket. The ball comes on the fly, and the ball also comes very fast. A good pitcher throws in excess of 90 miles an hour, and the pitcher we had for the Yankees today, who didn't do very well, was called Ron Guidry, and also nicknamed Louisiana Lightning. Louisiana is a state that he's from, he's a Cajun, someone who's from the bayous in the south of the United States, an area that's being flooded right now horribly. And so basically his idea, he's just not doing so well.
Right.
Now what he's done is hit into a double play, which is a ridiculously and stupid mistake. And that's why you hear the boos.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
It also has something called the Bronx cheer, which goes something like this. And something we also called the raspberries. And that's another signifier, if you're into semiology, that's about your opinion of what's going on. It means somebody, again, has done so badly that you're trying to explain to everybody else that you feel they've done badly also.
It seems slightly odd to me that a game of this magnitude is taking place at sort of 2 o'clock on, what, a Tuesday afternoon.
Right. Well, you'll notice all the people in suits here, right? These are people who have skipped work. Basically, our Georgia came with us as a lawyer.
Yeah.
People who say, oh, I've got something important to do. And they've come out to the game because it's practically filled. But people are starting to leave now because our team is losing by a horrible amount.
This is Yankees team.
Right, yeah. The Yankees. Again, Yankees is a term for a northerner. It's a general term for somebody who comes from the north.
Yeah.
And Susan, who's sitting next to you, is from the south, born in Mobile, Alabama,
yeah.
Who Yankees is a derogatory term. You Yankee, you, right? And so from her point of view, it's somewhat unpleasant to be sitting here rooting for a team called the Yankees. She's a rebel.
But the stadium isn't actually divided as it would be in some
English football matches. And it's also
Detroit supporters at one end and Yankee supporters at another.
Right. And everybody's drinking, and the goal is to have a good time, get relatively drunk, have hot dogs, or what we... Again, okay, now there's... Okay.
So
the opposite team has made an error.
Yeah.
And that just means a mistake.
Yeah. You know? Now, being a man of music, we seem to have little sort of inserts of an organist playing bits of music.
Right, and you also have, Robert Merrill, an opera singer, sang the national anthem. I think it was Robert Merrill today.
Yeah.
And you have this guy playing this sort of synthesized organ. And he comes in between whenever this seems like an appropriate time.
Yeah.
He'll play an incredibly horrible type of music, the kind of music you'd hear at a dentist office.
Yeah. So this is really a bit like the Oscars last night.
Yeah.
Take the train. Take the train. Take the train to the plane. Take the train to the plane. The train to the plane.
Well, I didn't think that this take would be complete without the homeward journey, or at least the takeoff and landing. I'm in fact in the Air India 747 at Kennedy Airport, about to take off for Heathrow after what I think was a very busy and hectic fortnight in New York. And as I was saying, we're actually at the end of the runway as one aeroplane amongst many in a queue, moving ahead gradually. In fact, the engines are accelerating now, and this is our takeoff. Thank you.
border on again when we're about to land at Heathrow. So some 6 hours later, here I am approaching Heathrow Airport on this Air India 747. And there it is. Britain salutes New York. John Cage doesn't salute Julian Schnabel. A commentary on the Yankees versus Detroit baseball game by Bob George, and a commentary on the New York art scene by Rosalie Goldberg. Ads by Charlie Morrow, car horn organ by Wendy Chambers, and other sound works by Joan LaBarbera and Anne Lockwood. Comment by Christopher Price MP, and briefly by the Mayor of New York, Edward Koch. So now it's back to London to put all this together. Now we're clearly over Richmond Park on our final descent to Heathrow. Just feel the wheels going down. I'm going over the River Thames, Richmond. Now for the landing. 20 feet above, 10 feet, 5.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have landed at Heathrow Airport, London. The local time is 9 a.m. and the outside temperature is 5 degrees Celsius. We shall stop here for approximately 1 hour and 45 minutes. Please remain seated till the fasten seatbelt sign is switched off. I repeat, please remain seated till the fasten seatbelt sign is switched off. Transit passengers.